We do a deep dive and explain why certain scenes in Barry's fifth episode might be worth a rewatch, plus what makes the new HBO series White House Plumbers so hilarious.
An elevator tape projection.
Hey, it's Taking It Down, where we prompt conversations for thoughtful, busy TV devotees from these irreverent outsiders. Welcome to this week's show. We're the TV podcast produced by the Alabama Take website. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the site. I just can't help dissecting why I like what I like and why I dislike what I dislike when it comes to TV and movies and more. With an English degree and a side hustle as an English teacher, I'll try my best to offer insight that you can use for conversation with others or even with us. Luckily, my ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints on the podcast each week, as with me are these hosts. Adam Morrow is an erudite traveling and studio musician with a penchant for fine literature. Donovan Reinwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more. And Natalie Morrow, the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyoncé's music. From us, you'll get the obvious and the obscure. We are here for the TV and streaming obsessed who are just too busy for anything more than the show or movie itself. We'll give the outside of Hollywood analysis, and like a lot of the Alabama Take productions, it comes with zero Southern stereotype. Let's get into the show. The usual suspects aren't here this week. Instead, I've got Alabama Take staffer and writer Ty Edmondson's joining me. Call him if you need some movie recs. Throw us a movie rec out there.
The Piano Teacher, directed by Michael Haneke.
What year?
That's a good one. I want to say it's late 90s.
Yeah?
I want to say 96, but I could be completely wrong about that and pulling that from somewhere. Let's see.
I don't pull it up. Who cares?
2001.
Did you... Yeah. Is that a recent one? I mean, recent watch
That's
for you?
That's a recent, like... Recent watch for me that I've, like, quickly loved.
Okay,
like,
The Piano Teacher, starring...
I do not know her name.
Is it a foreign actress?
Mm-hmm. It's a French film.
Oh, okay. You and Donovan are who I have to hit up for in-depth or old movie recs.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. You're eager to talk about Barry, so you were the first person I knew to call. If Natalie or Donovan can't make it, you're the first on my list. You're eager to talk about Barry, as am I. Listeners may not know this about you. You have a smattering of shows that you like, but you're not a big television guy.
Yeah.
But Barry's on your list.
Barry is on my list. Barry is overall probably on my top three list of favorite shows that I've seen, like, ever.
Albeit, we'll put the asterisk there. You're not a TV guy, but...
I'm not a TV guy. Okay, so not completely. I've seen, like, a lot of the basics, you know.
Mm-hmm. I got you. So we'll be spoiling up through episode 5. It's the fourth and final season we're talking about. I'm not going to set this up because we talked about it in the last few weeks past. Everybody's probably caught up with it. If you're listening to the podcast, we come out on Tuesday. We record over the weekend. So you probably have already watched another episode beyond what we're talking about. Just stick with us. Old Barry, or should we call him Clark now? He has moved into such a meager, desolate, I dare say, especially with Sally, a lonely existence. It's rough.
Miserable.
She's miserable. He seems...
Oh, yeah.
He seems okay with it.
I think he's content. And I think this is what he's wanted.
Yeah.
What I'll get into a little later, but I think that's mostly in part how he just really isn't trying into, like, making this new personality for himself other than, like, exactly what he wants to do. He's not giving more than he really should be. But Sally's miserable because she is actually giving everything into it.
Somewhere down the line, she quit giving, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Because
she obviously gave the kid, unless the kid's a kidnappee.
Mm-hmm. Which, that would be a little...
I mean, that's even darker than we thought.
Yeah. I don't even want to think about
that. Well, the kid just does not seem... Prospect. There's no connection between Sally. What is she going by now? Emily?
Yeah, I think.
There's no connection between her and the kid. The only thing that looked remotely mother and son was when she was holding him in the bathtub in that fetal-esque image.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's sad. It's a lonely existence. That's where they are, in the middle of nowhere. It looked like the High Plains of Wyoming, Kansas, sort of.
It's, yeah. It sounds and like looks like the place that we got a flashback to earlier in the season, where Barry like grew up and everything. And I was having a conversation with my brother about that and like my theory that like it is the same place. But he did make a good point of like, if Barry was trying to conceal his identity, why would he go back to his hometown? But at the same time, I don't know. Like, it's a it's too similar that it's either just a big analogy.
It is.
To him, to his home, or it's actually his home.
No, that's, I think that's it. Hader's just doing it as a stylistic choice. He's said it in a very similar place as when Fuchs, he first met Fuchs. It's, that's the idea. It's just, he's trying to repeat his childhood, except do it right this time with John, the kid. I mean, we've got a lot to talk about just with this episode alone. I will start with just Hader's line delivery of how's your dinner, John? And then he says, chicken pot pie. That. That's not where I want to start. God, I love that so much, though.
The whole episode is very funny. I mean, like all, like every episode of Barry is funny, but oh, goodness. It's just, there's so many little, like, they really do take dark comedy to, like, a different kind of area in this one, because it's not so dark to the point of, like, oh, it's showing, like, a bunch of death. It's just hilarious how controlling Bill Hader is in this sense for his child, like...
Well, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, like, when he picks up the baseball and he finds it and he shows him videos of injuries and he's just sitting there just clicking the play button on each one. It's just awful.
The whole idea of Barry Clark, whoever, homeschooling his kid, but the only way he's homeschooling is by showing him YouTube videos.
Oh, it's so funny.
That's a very Duncan homeschooling for a kid, by the way.
I just love the father like figure of him just like sitting there like laid back while his son just
he's watching his reaction. It's perfect. So well played.
And like the like Abe Lincoln stories and him sharing the controversial things that Abe Lincoln has done. Oh, it's funny. It's funny. It's really good.
Very well written. An idea here, though, I think that the show's doing is that Barry has in him this innate cruelty almost that has to be stopped with his son. He can't pass down this generational trauma, right?
Yeah.
And that's what he's trying to do. We mentioned the controlling aspect that he's basically got little Barry in John, and he's trying to cut this off. I've got to do it right this time, like as if that's going to be my redemption. I don't think he can be redeemed, I guess, at this point. That's the question, maybe.
That's a constant thing with just Barry as a whole and his character is, like, every time that he does something wrong, it's, like, a common line in the series, the this end starting now, and, like, him, like, pointing down when he does that.
Oh, yeah.
He does that every single time he messes up. And even Alan, at the end of season 3... as soon as Barry, like right before Barry kills or tries to kill
Kusina?
Jim Moss, Jim Moss, Alan says, like, this ends now, like, I'm giving you one more chance, that's it. And then, obviously, it leads to him being imprisoned. Yeah, like you said, I don't think there's a way for Barry to really redeem what he's already done, especially how this entire episode is kind of a this ends now moment. And then at the very end, I have to go kill Gene Cousineau.
Exactly.
Like, the moment something goes wrong in Barry's life, death and destruction is the only possible way he can compute to, like, fix that.
Perfectly, perfectly well said. Exactly a point I was going to bring to the table was he wants to kill Gene, and this may be one of the first times, correct me if I'm wrong, he wants to kill Gene not because it's going to save his life, but because Gene wants to tell the story of Barry, and Barry doesn't want that story told. Like, it's not that Gene's going to reveal where he is. It's not that Gene's going to find him through going to Hollywood and making a movie.
Yeah.
They don't even know he's around. It's just being selfish, maybe to the point where we haven't seen him this quite selfish. Usually when he was shooting and killing, it was like, they're going to find out I've shot and killed so-and-so.
Yep.
It was a different, I've got to kill somebody reaction.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I was thinking. His first selfish moment of him, not selfish a moment of him, but the first time he wants to kill out of selfish and not self-preservation.
Yeah, big time. Because that's one thing is perfectly said, is just the way that, like, this really and truly the biopic will not affect him. And even in this, even in this, like, country area that he's in, where I haven't even seen a TV the entire time that they've been there, I doubt anyone is going to go out and be watching a Barry biopic anytime soon, or if not, even correlating it with him.
Barry doesn't leave the house much.
I've noticed that he doesn't have a job, is what it seems like, at least. And I think that's in part due to the controlling nature of him.
Yeah.
Not only, I have no doubt in my mind that Barry made Sally get a job and support them so that Barry could spend time with his son.
Yeah.
And be the father of the household.
Which is why I think the kidnapping's not out of the question.
I really agree. Especially the 8-year time jump. And I don't know how old he is.
I think he's like 8 or 7.
Is he 8 or 7?
I think he is, yeah. I think. Okay. Maybe I'm just dreaming that.
It's just a narrow window of time for everything to be going on.
You wanted to talk about some specific choices made from directing point of view. That's kind of your bread and butter. Boy, there was some serious serial killer scariness between Sally / Emily, how she's thrilled with choking Bevel, her shady, seedy coworker in the bathroom there. Mm-hmm. That played like a scene from that movie Monster. Did you ever see that with Charlize Theron, where she's just totally changed her look? And
oh, goodness. That sounds so familiar.
It's a biopic, too, in a way, or a true crime.
I've heard of this.
Based on a real person who... a real lady who was a serial killer, one of the few.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that scene does have that serial killer vibe, as if it's from a serial killer movie, except this time it's Sally doing it. And it harkens back on her being abused, and she's getting such a rush out of this because she's finally getting a chance to choke the guy again.
Yeah.
Because the one time she did get to do it, she killed somebody in season 3.
Even you going on about this kind of serial killer vibe that you're getting from that, I even get kind of, I haven't seen the show, but I know exactly what it's about. I even get kind of a Dexter-like idea from her, because something that I picked up on immediately is you see Sally in the conversation before with this worker saying, like, oh, have you ever done anything like that? Have you ever killed anybody? Have you ever shot anybody like that? And then instantly... she takes that aggression out on him almost immediately. And to me, I see that as a way for, like, Sally conquering what you even said of her being abused and conquering the type of, like, violent men that she's been stuck with her life and, like, constantly had to deal with. And this is her, like, not necessarily small, but, like, way of, even though it's not directly affecting Barry or her past I forget his name, or her, like, ex-husband who abused her.
I forget.
Who abused her. It's still a way for her to feel like she's somehow deterring this, like, this violent person from doing something like that to either a woman or even, like, other people down the line. Because he's frightened instantly.
Yes.
Like, he begs, basically, for his life.
She's scary in that scene. She's choking Barry as much as she's choking Bevel. And the fact that they chose Bevel as a name is probably as fitting as... it's a really weird choice. That's as fitting as anything. We get this motif running through the episode of great people who have big flaws. That's the way TV viewers probably view Barry in season 1. Like, oh, he's still okay. He's just got this flaw. It's a serial killer. And we've all seen these shows where you're thinking, but I pull for Tony Soprano, but Tony Soprano murders people every week. It's tough if you are legitimately concerned about your ethics, but at the same time, we know it's fiction. You know, we can drop that. But there's this theme of people not being whom you initially believe. In Clark's stories about war, he's a medic. He's not the murderer. He's not, well, in war, he's not the soldier who kills. I really thought that was well-stitched.
I agree.
Alec Berg, Bill Hader writing on this. Man, I just love little things like that where they're sprinkled throughout, and then at the end or at the end of a season, you just see the needlework of the whole blanket.
Bill Hader in general, just the way that he is in this episode is, like, fantastic, especially with what you're saying of comparing, like, the bad things that historical figures have done with, like, the way that, like, Barry and, like, the viewer sees Barry in, like, the first couple of seasons in the show as, like, kind of a lovable guy, but mm-hmm. in reality, like, he's done awful things.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite thing about this episode and, like, relating to Barry is the fact that Barry and Sally are technically both still living their dream, and they're acting every single day. Like, they're pulling mm-hmm. off this role of completely different people than they've started, and that's what they've always wanted. They've always wanted to act, especially Barry. And one thing that I found so amazing that Bill Hader wrote in was the way that Barry is so excited to tell his son this story of his military experience in his own way, and puts out, like, the plaque in the desert for him to, like, go and get. And, like, it's this theatric. It really is. He sets up this theatric in a similar way that his classmates were setting up the theatric and acting out what actually happened that day where he shot and killed, like, that innocent person. And they were acting out the time that he first got his first kill, like, sniping. And instead of Barry gaining this kind of emotional resonance through that, like, story to further, like, act and, like, get this kind of, like, reason to keep acting and, like, this emotion from this story, he instead tells a complete lie about the story to similarly gain a feeling of wholeness. And he feels as if he can tell his son and make him believe this mm-hmm. and keep this acting persona up, then it's basically just the same as telling Gene this and Gene telling him to act it out instead, which I found really interesting.
It goes right back to him needing to kill Gene at the end, because Gene's mm-hmm. going to tell his story and he's not going to have his role, so to speak, in it. Sally's getting to act every day. She's putting on this country accent or whatever you want to call it, Midwestern even. Maybe, mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure, but it's just a word.
It's something.
It's something. It's not Sally. Well, she is kind of Midwestern. She's from Missouri anyway. She's putting on a wig, but boy, she's mm-hmm. not acting in the roles she wanted, you know, the mega girl roles or the Joplin show on the streaming channel. I think my favorite thing about this is that it had this stylized presentation that's reminiscent of how a lot of shows do dreaming. Like, if you would have told mm-hmm. me at the end that this episode was all a dream,
oh yeah,
I mean, that would have been really schlocky and stupid. But if you would have told me that just, like, it's a dream, can't you see that it is, I would have said, oh wow, yeah, of course, because the solitude of the house, the lack of lighting at night when he goes outside the house. It's just, you just get, it's like scary in a way. The desolation, and even Sally, and when she's this Emily and she's pouring coffee or about to serve the guys, that shot is askew to where you can only see the guy's head. It's kind of mm-hmm. a, we're cutting off this guy's head kind of thing. All he does is look up and nod, and then we get Sally in the corner. It's just, that shot is just a bit abnormal.
Like a dream, like when you're in a dream, you don't really recognize anything. Nothing is mm-hmm. recognizable, the same way that this environment that they're in, it's never stated where they are.
Yeah.
It's never stated, even the time jump isn't even stated, how like long the time jump has mm-hmm. been. I think it may be, like, lightly, but I know Bill Hader has confirmed that it's 8 years.
They say... that might be where I got his age from, because they say eight years old, maybe.
But yeah, I'm sure they do. But even that is, like, lightly mentioned, and it's never said, like, in most shows it'll show like a title card and say, like, Western Missouri or, like, something like that. Right. But here that's never stated. The only shots you see of the outside are a barren, like, desert almost. And then when Sally's outside at a gas station and it looks abandoned and run down, and no, there's no cars inside, it's just Sally. And I really like the feeling that you get from this episode, which is you feel the same way, I think more Sally, how Sally feels, mm-hmm. which is completely and totally alone.
Oh,
and there's this one shot that I've talked to you about, which is possibly my favorite shot in the entire show that I've noticed so far, because how immediately I picked up on what Bill Hader was doing mm-hmm. With directing it. And it's the shot where you first see Sally putting on her wig. Her back is turned to us, and there's a mirror that's showing her face. And then in the window, you see Barry playing with his son.
Oh, yeah.
And he's jovial, and his son is happy, and they're just playing and throwing a ball back and forth. And Sally is completely silent and putting a wig on. And the audience at this point is confused at why Sally's putting a wig on and why Barry just has glasses on, and that's the only thing he's doing to put forth this kind of act that he's holding on. While Sally is getting ready for work and having to go through this entire process of doing her makeup and putting her wig on and making sure everything is right, Barry is just kind of in the distance playing with his son and like not worrying about what's going on. And he's just being a father while Sally is having to go and worry about everything. And I think it's fitting that Sally is the one that is discovering that Jean is trying to make a biopic about Barry. Sally's still watching her old assistant's show, which is like the cupcake thing that she mentioned in the third season. And I just think it's really fitting that Sally is super disconnected from whatever is going on right now to her, but super still connected to everything that is happening and what she once had and what life she once held.
Yeah, no. That even kind of plays into how the scenes change from one to the other. This is an editing trick that they do. It's not a trick. It's an editing choice they make. Usually with any show, you get almost a quick, unnoticeable edit. Here you get a whole black screen where each scene is separated from the next very blatantly. It's just reminiscent of how probably Sally is disconnected from everything. Maybe. I don't know. It's almost like these are vignettes you're getting rather than a cohesive show. That shot of her in the bathtub, to me, the prison with the kid almost.
That's gorgeous too.
It is. You could really break down this particular episode something. I don't know, shot by shot. Yeah. You could do scene by scene. Nice flip from the previous episode where instead of almost no Barry, you get all Barry.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get almost no other characters other than Jean at the end, tacked on.
Yeah.
What else you got for us? Are there any? I know you want to talk about a few shots. What other ones you have? I really like that one you brought up with the. It was so noticeable, and I'm glad you brought it up with her with the wig and then the juxtaposition.
I also like the one where Barry is standing outside with like the gun, and he's standing there, and if I remember correctly. After it cuts from Sally laying in the bathtub with her son, it's like daytime. And Barry is still standing in the same exact position.
That's
with
right.
The same, like, same framing and everything.
That's right.
And I love that so much because it shows, like we were talking about earlier, how Barry is still so animalistic and ready to be violent that he's standing out there just waiting for something to happen for him to shoot at. And that's it. And I think what ended up being knocking was some children is what I assume is someone playing a prank because I heard kids laughing in the distance whenever he walks outside. And the fact that he definitely heard that, but he stays.
Yeah.
Like he's ready for anything and he's ready to be violent again at the drop of a pin, which I thought was really interesting. And one just like final thing that I saw on Twitter, and I'm completely stealing this from someone, but I saw someone make the really cool comparison that you may have made, but I didn't even catch, between Clark and him putting a pair of glasses on and being a new person, and Clark Kent, and like Superman, and like how Clark Kent just puts a pair of glasses on, he's Clark now, and then takes them off, and he's Superman, and like it's that, it's like he does nothing outside his identity, and it's kind of a like long running joke in like the superhero community that like. All these superheroes are wearing masks and stuff, but he just wears a pair of glasses the same way. That's literally all that Barry does. Hey. Barry doesn't put on a new accent or anything.
We'll give Barry a little credit. He did put the beer belly on.
he did do that. Maybe unintentionally, but he did.
A little age.
Sitting around the entire time. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The last two seasons were large swaths of him doing things out of self-preservation, but... it's just next level here. It's not so much self-preservation. It's just control. We'll begin our wrap here on this episode of Barry. Would you watch Larry Chowder, Magical Boy? Larry Chowder. What a name. Mega Girls 4. I'm sure we'll watch Mega Girls 4.
I'd check Mega Girls 4 out.
Okay.
Me and my family were laughing at that as they popped up because of it's that. I mean, that's what it's become at this point. I mean... Let's be real. That's what movies are.
Luckily, we don't have to pick, but what would you prefer? The version of the show Barry where we get all the other characters and a little Barry at the end? Or do you like all Barry and a little of the other characters at the end?
I think I like... I don't want to give up NoHo Hank, but I think yeah. I think I like all Barry.
I do too.
Just because it's so complex. He's a very good character, and yeah. Bill Hader is fantastic, and I cannot wait to see him act in other roles.
Yeah. I might have said this last season. I think it was last season with the episode with the dirt bike going down the interstate in California. Remember that episode?
Yes, that's one of my favorite episodes.
I think I said it on this podcast that I would not be surprised if Bill Hader's winning an Oscar in 6 years for a movie.
Absolutely.
And that would be awesome. A shame that he wouldn't be in front of the camera as much, but still cool. Mm-hmm. He seemed like a cool cat anyway.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to take a break. We'll talk some White House Plumbers. Stick with some HBO shows here. White House Plumbers on the other side. If you're a book lover, no one has to tell you the wonder and excellence of a great book. But finding someone to talk about it? That's sometimes the problem. Well, not anymore. The best book podcast is here. Find Check Your Shelf one Wednesday of each month on thealabamatake.com or in any podcast app. You'll hear host Jamie Hanna and guests give a pleasant, insightful version of a book club as they cover notable reads every month. Subscribe where you get your podcast or simply go to the Alabama Take and find Check Your Shelf. Okay, next up on our podcast, we're going to talk HBO again. I swear to y'all, we are not an HBO podcast. The last 2 weeks, that's all we covered. But they're still doing pretty good television. We'll see if it changes when they go only Max or whatever they're going to do.
Oh, goodness.
I hope the quality doesn't drop. Everyone online seems to be scared that might be the case, but here's hoping. We're going to talk the 5-part miniseries White House Plumbers. It stars Woody Harrelson and Justin Theroux. Two of my personal favorites. Don't know. We'll let Ty chime in. You're a Harrelson guy.
I love Woody Harrelson. He's been in my second favorite show, which is True Detective Season 1. And that is a performance of a lifetime for him, in my opinion. I absolutely love him in that role.
See, I was so hoping you were going to say Cheers. He is so good in Cheers. Hey.
I've never seen it. I've never seen it.
Right before you go to bed tonight, watch an episode of Woody as Woody in Cheers. Yeah, one of his best roles. Woody Harrelson is in it. Justin Theroux in this show, White House Plumbers. Woody Harrelson plays E. Howard Hunt, real person. And Theroux plays J. Gordon Liddy, real person. And I remember Gordon Liddy a lot.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Because he went on to become a shock jock radio right-wing...
Oh, goodness.
Fox analyst kind of guy.
I mean, in the show, he seems like he would be. But
he's a perfect fit. But if those two character names... Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy sound familiar to you, it's because they're not characters. They are real-life people, not in a fictional sense, in a historical sense. These are men who were alive. I think they both died within the last 10 years or so. Central guys to Nixon's Watergate scandal. I was excited for this series for a couple reasons. Acting, directing, I knew them. I knew with Harrelson and Theroux, it would be pretty good. But every role... is well cast. Oh, yeah. Lena Headey from Game of Thrones is playing Howard Hunt's wife. She's showing up as a former CIA agent and wife to Howard Hunt. And top down, it's well cast. The creators are another reason why I was excited. They are renowned for Veep, which I never watched all the way through, but... Mm-hmm. I know that it was funny when I did watch it. It's Alex Gregory and Peter Hewick, I think his name is. And the last reason why I was super excited and I just dove right into this show is because I think a lot of people know Watergate scandal, but if you're like me, you just kind of sort of know the outline. You don't know.
Yeah.
And so far, this show is getting a lot of it supposedly right. We're going to spoil the first two episodes. Starting now, so just in case you're not caught up, what was your opinion of the first two episodes?
I thought it was really entertaining, especially since it's a a show and a topic that I really wouldn't normally like watch something, but the like five episodes really intrigued me because I didn't want to have to stay for too long. That's... And Woody Harrelson also intrigued me. But I also love the opening like scene of the first episode really like hooked me, and I was like, okay, this will be very interesting because I just love that. It says, like, this is a true story and we're not blurring, like, any names because most of these people are guilty, which is hilarious in and of itself, but it's also very true. And I also did not know that there were four attempts to break into Watergate, which is extremely hilarious and played for laughs in the show, and it's done really well. But I also was very interested in this because you never, ever, ever... at least what I've learned in class and, like, government class, and you know how it is. But you never learned about who was behind Watergate or what they did even beforehand and how they were connected to the whole scandal. You just learned that Watergate happened and it was a bad thing and people got caught, and that was about it.
Nixon had to resign. That's about
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Hunt did 33 months in jail for this, and Liddy did 53 months in federal prison. I did not expect this to be as funny as it was.
It was.
The first episode especially. I'm going to stick with the first episode for a second. I love bumbling idiots who think they're way more intelligent than they are.
I have that written down. I have that written down about how actually idiotic they are, and how played up for laughs it is, which I just love about this show so far.
The moment I was sold on the show and I thought, well, I'm going to watch all of this no matter what, was rather than putting on Gordon Liddy. Gordon Liddy has over Howard Hunt, you know, and he... rather than putting on jazz or some kind of nice music, he puts on a Hitler album, like Hitler speechifying. And it is so loud that they're just yelling at one another in the living room over Hitler.
And also the funniest part about that scene to me in particular is Howard's wife, like right before, talks about how she worked recovering art from like Nazis and like... she's very, I mean, who's not anti-Nazi, but she's very clearly not, like, a fan of whatever Lydia is about to start playing. And he's like, I have something that'll interest you. And at first, my mind's racing, like, oh, it's going to be, like, some art piece or, like, something that he has that, like, relates to her occupation. No, it's Hitler speeches played at max volume on a record player, which is just amazing. And it's a very funny moment.
Here's the perfect thing, too. Around 2004, in his shock jock radio guy persona, Liddy really did admit to, as a kid, that he would listen to Hitler to get pumped up. But then he had to backtrack and be like, but I don't agree with him. What he did was evil.
I think that's even mentioned specifically in this, is Howard and Liddy are having a conversation.
Yeah.
And he says, and he asks, he's like, you're not a Nazi, are you? Because Howard is this super, like, right-wing conservative. He even says, like, at points, like, them liberals and them hippie junkies and, like, all that kind of stuff. Like, it's super just, like, conservative as you would see it. He even asked him if he's not Nazi. He's like, no, just, like, when I was younger and I would hear Hitler's speeches, it gave me hope and it just made me feel strong. And, like, it's the same as saying, oh, I agree with this. Like, it makes me feel powerful. Like, it makes me want to go do the things he's saying. Like, it's the exact same. It's just you're gaining a reason to go out on your day because of Hitler. It's just very funny. And I didn't know that was true.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes it a lot better.
Oh, yeah. The exact quote, yes. And now it's taken out of context and put in the show, the year of the show, which he very well could have said it to Hunt, too. Who knows?
Yeah.
But no, he said that in 2004. Or he at least really had to comment on it again in 2004. These guys the writers find so much humor in this beautifully ironic lack of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. When Hunt, Harrelson as Hunt, says, the Cubans will do it for free. And Justin Thoreau as Gordon Liddy says, yeah, real Americans. It's like there's no awareness to what they just said.
There's a lot of those moments.
Exactly.
There's a lot of those moments in there, and I really appreciate it. And I also just love that you don't see a political show that just follows a duo of two idiots a lot. And even on the outside, I had no clue what this show was about. And I think it being named the White House Plumbers is extremely intentional. So it knows what it's talking about, because the name Plumbers is only used for 20 minutes of one episode.
Right.
And then they're the committee to reelect the president or whatever, yeah. Which is funny in itself.
But White House Plumbers is also true.
Yeah.
A true name.
Yeah. White House Plumber is like that being used is just a funny thing in and of itself. I keep saying that, but a funny thing because like you think of like janitors and plumbers as kind of like a lower level of occupation in an area and in like a location. Here, it's played for like laughs. Of it truly is a lower occupation, as these people cannot do anything right.
That's true.
No matter how hard they try. Other than, like, at the end of the second episode, which is even done by chance, they cannot really do anything right as hard as they try, which I really enjoy and like about this.
Yeah, that does make it so enjoyable. I think I saw the phrase used on Vulture, they're failing upward. They're failing, but every
they're
time...
They're somehow continuing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they failed their big operation in the first episode, and then are promoted right after.
Yeah,
and
they are.
And even he goes like, oh, like, how much money we need? He goes like $1 million. He's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then they just walk out. Like, they're so trusted after failing something so huge.
Yeah.
For the government, which is really funny.
Now, they get that taken back in episode two.
Yeah.
Man, episode one was just the perfect tone for this because they're buffoons. And that is such the way it is in politics still, to me.
Yeah,
there's just such this through line or parallel from Watergate to what's happened in 2016 to in 2020 and now 2023. Yeah. I mean, take Trump on CNN just last week, that still proclaiming he won the last election. Like, that's exactly these guys, except now they've fallen their way even up to the presidency itself. So,
and I mean, just watch any debate. Any presidential debate, and both sides look like idiots. Like, it's clear.
Speaking of maybe a little bit more sad parallel with reality, how high did your eyebrows raise when Liddy brings a gun into work and says, everyone's a lot safer with this baby around? It's like,
I loved
what we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's obviously satire on everything that's going on right now and how readily accessible guns are and how often mass shootings happen and shootings in general. But I also love, he's so fascinated with it. You know, oh, it's German, it's lethal, it's silent, but it can get the job done quickly. And like, he's inspecting it and stuff. And it just mimics a lot of what we see with how stupid people can get guns very quickly. And
that's so well said. But Liddy, another true point that they've made into a reoccurring joke is that Liddy was really big on just killing people as an answer.
Yeah.
Hey, like, the kids threw eggs at his house and he would get the gun. He presents all these posters to John Mitchell and he's like, well, we could kill him. We could take him to Mexico and kill these guys. Liberal opponents, let's kill him. Kill Jack Anderson. The guy says, go. And he instantly leaves.
That was my favorite part. That was the funniest. That had me genuinely dying out laughing.
Yeah.
Is when he goes, oh, like what's something we could do to like really just get the stop? And he's like, oh, just kill Jack Anderson. And he just instantly turns around and leaves. And he even suggests killing the woman that
that's right.
I forget her name. Yeah, he even suggests killing her as well. That
Nita Beard
ends up the wrong thing happens with the memo and Jack Anderson and everything like that. He suggests killing her as well. But like you said, I love seeing him, his house getting egged, and you can see him like in the background of this Hitler speech still going on and then trying to have a conversation.
He leaves.
And he's running. Yeah, he leaves and he's running around like in the back trying to look for him.
I encourage you, if you haven't, anyone listening, anyone watching, you, Ty, go watch just a 2-minute segment of Gordon Liddy talking and Thoreau's playing this note perfectly.
Is it perfect?
Oh my goodness. I know that actors and shouldn't just shoot to imitate or do a caricature, but God, he's just nailing it. It fits so well with the idiot that Liddy was. So
yeah.
Why not do it exactly like Liddy if you can? And he looks like him, a young G. Gordon Liddy. The second episode drops a little more of the slapstick stuff, which I found very, very funny. I did think that the second episode wasn't as good. It was a bit slower because of the lack of slapstick humor. But it's probably more accurate that Hunt goes to the bedside of Dita Beard and persuades her to change her story under oath. That's true to life, but it was totally different than some of the first episodes. I get that you got to have it in there. It's Harrelson getting an opportunity to kind of add a layer to Hunt, maybe, because it was hard for me to dissect. Is he playing this as a man who sincerely knows that family's important, or is he playing this as a guy who really does not know that he's missing his family right there?
That's something that I really enjoyed about this episode, is the idea that you don't know if Hunt actually believes what he's saying in the way of family comes before country and family comes before like your workplace and everything, because he's not showing that in his actions whatsoever. And even at closer to the end where, or I think this is actually before he has this conversation with her, but it is, where he thinks that solving the problem is just kicking the door down and rushing into like his daughter who isn't listening to him and refuses to come out of the bathroom that she's locked herself away in. He believes that like that shows that he cares, that he's just gonna violently kick the door down and save her that way, which obviously isn't really like in a physical way. Yeah, he's getting to her, but he's not actually resonating with her, which you see at the end of that episode when they have a very unexpected anger clash just from him getting mad. Yeah, of Scrabble, just from him getting mad about the rules.
Well, there it is again. You get this irony of him demanding you play by the rules of Scrabble, but he is not playing by the rules of the nation, of law. And I'm sure so much of this is real. These people are, like, there's so much cognitive dissonance with them. Like, I follow the rules with Scrabble, but then you're breaking the law just 5 hours ago.
And in his exact quote, there's like anarchy without law, or there's like no order without law, which he hasn't been following the law this entire time throughout everything.
No, it's good to make Harrelson the smarter of the two dummies, and more reasonable.
I agree. And
Dumb and Dumber here.
Especially when normally you would kind of see Harrelson in general, just the attitude that he carries on, as kind of the dumber, like, Southern conservative, and like, but in reality, he is the smarter of the two.
It goes back to him on Cheers. If you watch him on Cheers, he plays the complete idiot, the Midwestern boy from a farm. It's so good. Oh, Dita Beard, by the way, did you recognize that actress? Do you know Kathleen Turner?
I don't think I do.
She's really made up differently in this. As soon as she talked, though, I kept thinking, is that Kathleen Turner?
Wait.
Very famous actress, early 80s.
Oh, I definitely
I'm
have
sure you've seen her.
Her
in something.
I did not know that was her, though. Yeah. Like, I didn't. Yeah.
I know. Well, she's also older, but they have her made out to look like a Dita Beard in a 70s, you know, bit of get up. To me, this show's about, it's about that scene with the Scrabble. It's about men who make their kids play by the rules when it comes to board games, but not so much themselves when it comes to actual laws. And I think that's what we're dealing with still to this day. We're governed by people who demand we play by the rules, but they
don't. I also think that's interesting when you look at when Liddy is introducing his children to Howard. He is like making them say like, welcome, like, we're so glad that you're here, and we know you worked with the like CIA and the FBI, and like, we're so excited for you to come here. And like, it's such a funny contrast when he's doing all that for his children, but he's genuinely advocating for murdering people just to solve political problems. Yeah. very minor political problems.
In some cases, yeah. So we know where this ends, but it's the getting there. Yeah. Boy, it's fun. I'm glad you're enjoying it because I kind of talked you into this one just to have a second segment. But you're right. It's five episodes. I'm in it. I'm in.
And it's funny.
Oh, man. It's sometimes... I think the scene with him putting on the Hitler record will live with me forever.
It's great. That one came unexpected to me, and I really, really enjoyed that.
It's almost like a Farrelly Brothers movie or like something out of Airplane.
Yeah, it is.
They're shouting at each other, and then you got kids outside throwing eggs, and he runs and gets a gun. It's Hitler still blasting.
Yeah, it's everything going on at the same time and nothing making sense, but it's still his wife is acting like everything's normal. Like this is like a normal night. Nothing's happening.
And that actress is well-known and well-played. She's from all kinds of things. She's from Ant-Man series and Arrested Development. She's in it. But the looks Harrelson's giving Lena Headley in those scenes, his wife, it's just like, we've got to get the fuck out of here. I love that. Yep, that show's White House Plumbers. I think it airs on Mondays. Watch it on HBO or HBO Max. And we'll stop here, but we'll be back next Tuesday for another episode of Taking It Down. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Taking It Down Pod. Everything Alabama Take related is on social media, just under the Alabama Take. Follow us there. It's a whole bunch of us there, including me and Ty. So check in with us. Let us know what you think. We'll talk to everybody next week.